Talk given Friday, 2nd November 1979. You may recall that when we last met, we talked about the meaning of the word person. What a profound meaning it has. If you look into its Sanskrit derivation, the Sanskrit word for person, of course, is Purusha, we see that it means he in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. And if all evil-mindedness is burnt out really means completely transmuted into pure psycho-spiritual energy, if that is the case, then that person is not an obstructor of the life process. He doesn't stand in the way of the fulfillment of the trends of life in mankind. Not the trends as we see them in actual manifestation in our world today, but that mysterious far-off goal towards which mankind is evolving. And that evolution, especially includes the evolution of his consciousness. This growth in consciousness, which enables him to become the perfect instrument for the full manifestation of transcendence as perfected man through him, because he has become the unresisting one. Unresisting not because he wills not to resist, but because he is completely in harmony with the life process. And therefore, the perfected manhood is manifest through that person. And that is the real meaning of the word person. And we also saw that each individual is masculine and feminine simultaneously. The masculine body has feminine characteristics. The feminine body has masculine characteristics. And as and when these are in perfect harmony, that person as a whole individual is there. Whole in the sense of the harmonized individual, the indivisible. His other task after that is, having come to perfect egohood, egohood in the true sense, that means completely devoid of all egoism, his further task consists in letting his consciousness expand freely, function so freely, so unresistingly, that he gets into touch with the totality of his environment. Then the indivisibility, the individuality of the whole world, of the whole universe, is manifest through him as man. Now, as far as we know and as far as we are concerned, on this globe, this can happen only through man. And so we may say that is one way of regarding the nature of man's destiny. The fulfillment of the purpose of his existence. Now, of course, obviously, this happens very rarely in the world. But it has happened in human history, again and again. And because it has happened so often, comparatively often, and those people, those perfected men, have taught, have shown the way to this consummation of man's destiny. And it is this teaching which is specifically religious teaching. And it is a teaching of such a nature that he who lives the religious life lives as a whole being in which everything else is completely subsumed. In the case of such a person, there is no such thing as a private life and a public life, a secular life and a specialized religious life. His life is the totality of life. It is the sort of life which expresses the perfection of politics, economics, sociology, everything. He knows how to live completely in harmony with everything else. But we must be careful not to define that harmony according to our lights, because he may teach, he may speak, he may write, and he may live in a manner which in some instances might seem to us reprehensible. But then we must bear in mind, who am I, the individual, still growing towards that perfect manhood, to lay down criteria or standards of judgment for the perfected Holy One? That is the point. Now, we also touched last time upon this point, that as one becomes the true individual, one is in touch, one is sensitive to the archetypal cosmical forces of the world. These energies, which are expressions of the primordial creative energy, the one primordial creative energy which brings everything into being, are the archetypal expressions which we can contact as human beings. Assuming that we as human beings can contact all that is allowed us as human beings to contact, we mustn't think that is the whole. There are bound to be many other archetypal expressions which we will never contact. However perfected we become, simply because throughout the universe, through all different types of manifestation, there are limitations imposed because manifestation is limited. It is finite. It is particular. That is why there is variety. The totality as a totality has no variety. It has no characteristics. Now perhaps I'm putting it not quite the right way. If it has characteristics, I can't define them. Because its characteristics at its transcendent level will be indefinable by me at the non-transcendental level. I can only talk in terms of the transcendent, which bear correspondence to me as a human being. And you may remember some months ago, we saw that the implications of that extraordinary statement in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, that the Atma, looking around, saw nothing other than itself. But it realized itself in man form. Remember that term? Purusha Vida. In man form. Because we are men, human beings, the ultimate we can see in terms of expressible manifestation will ultimately be in our own terms, as anthropomorphic terms. This is how theisms come into being. When you get a completely impersonal, non-theistic presentation, it has no characteristics. We use a word like the absolute. Well, what do we mean by the absolute? It's completely unimaginable, unthinkable. We can say the word absolute, realizing that that word represents something, that which is completely outside the limitations imposed by the relative. It is not the opposite of the relative, but it subsumes the relative. And therefore it remains the everlasting mystery. In the same way, the word God, or the word Brahman, or whatever word you like, subsumes all this and also remains the unknown mystery. But it is this unknown mystery which is the extraordinary creative energy which constantly draws everything towards fulfillment. How? We don't know. And I doubt if we can ever know. Because if we can even begin to know something about that, most likely we would stop talking altogether. Because it's indescribable. Any description given limits. It defines. So that you can distinguish it from an other. But where totality, where the absolute is concerned, the concept an other doesn't apply. There is no other where totality is concerned. You can't have two totalities. You see? Now it is very important for us to appreciate points like this. These archetypal powers, just to finish off that aspect of things, these archetypal expressions at the cosmical level have been contacted, have been sensed in some way or other by many people, probably by millions of people, without our knowing it. Because every one of us has certain very deep, subtle sensitivities. And at some time or other in our lives, we sort of become aware of something and we say, oh yes, that was wonderful, but I can't tell you about it. Something which eludes any clear presentation. Now, it is this sensitivity to these archetypal, cosmical manifestations of energy which are represented in the names of the gods, of the various pantheons, of the archangels, the angels, and so forth. The whole host and furniture of heaven, I think Milton used that phrase, didn't he? Yes, you see, the whole host and furniture of heaven. Well, if we consider the particular forms which we give when we start talking about them, we will find that they become more and more misleading. It is sufficient to suggest that something like this is active, is present. You take the name, for example, Michael, the archangel, and Michael means he who is like God. If you take Gabriel, he is the leader of the hosts and stands for the strength and the power of God. Raphael, the healer. We have in the languages in India and also in the Semitic world something like the root sound rafu, meaning to mend, to make whole, to mend. Raphael, see, at the cosmic level, is the healer, and so forth. So, human beings, however immersed as a mass they may be with worldliness, perhaps right through their lives, nevertheless throw up so many individuals who have these deeper sensitivities active. And if we learn to understand the meaning of their names, the particular meaning, and the not only the actual denotation but the connotations too, there is so much we can learn about ourselves. Now, this presentation in terms of thought forms, because after all, when we say the Archangel Michael, or if we use another word, Yahoel in the Hebrew, also called Metatron, the transfigured Enoch, identified with Yahoel after his being taken up into the seventh heaven by God. His name is an abbreviation of Yahweh himself. And it is similar, therefore, to the meaning of Michael. and is placed by God on a throne next to the throne of glory. These are the imaginative expressions to suggest man's sensitivity, which experiences this something mysterious, indescribable. Afterwards, it feels like that. And therefore, one talks in such terms. But the moment one has talked in such terms and actually thrown out an expression in terms of concepts and words, it tends to degenerate into a fixed picture. And that is where the difficulty comes. One must be free from fixations. You know how artists have represented throughout the world, they have represented archangels and angels according to their aesthetic sense, working upon their sensitivity. But once an artist has done that, and thousands of people see, they say, oh, that's Michael, that's Yahweh, that's Mr. John, that's so and so. And they just hang on to the dead picture. That picture is a dead one. It's not a live thing. Whereas these energies, these different archetypal forms of the creative energy are absolutely alive. And this is why one must never try to meddle with these deeper energies. That is one of the dangers of yoga, especially the Hatha Yoga and the Kundalini Yoga. There are dangers involved there. Because one increases one's sensitivity without sufficient preliminary preparation as far as the purification of one's entire psyche is concerned. Then it has, very subtly, without one's knowing how it happens, a steadily shattering effect upon the psyche, which also can affect the body. We know very well, for instance, in India, we have had many cases where the practicant, well, goes off his head. Or he becomes inordinately egoistic. Says, I am God. Without the slightest reason for saying such a thing. Have we ever heard God himself say, hello old boy, I am God? You see how easy it is to go off the rails. No good sense in making such statements. One must never claim anything. And here the Buddha expressly laid down amongst his teachings to be silent with regard to what you yourself can do in such directions. If you can do it, and if you do it silently, quietly, all right, you can benefit your environment, and there is a benefit to yourself accruing too. If not, if you pretend or show off, You are a usurper and not the rightful person who can sit upon that chair. One has to be very, very careful about these things. Later on in life, if the effects are become very powerful and one has passed the point of no return, there is a definite shattering of the constitution. So the most important thing to bear in mind is this preliminary of the moral preparation, which is the purification in terms of living the virtuous life, and also the mental purification, the freeing of the mind from all preconceptions, assumptions, prejudices, biases. In other words, to make the mind completely open-minded, not gullible, not credulous, nor, on the other hand, incredulous. This has to be carefully borne in mind. Then the Holy One is holy, and one of his outstanding characteristics is that he is the perfect observer. You may have heard that phrase, the silent watcher. He who watches silently. That is ascribed to those in Buddhistic terms, especially, not so much in Brahmanical terms, that is applied to what one may one may describe as the Master of Masters, the Silent Watcher. And in that silent watching, an extraordinary thing happens. Not only is he aware in perfection of how others are functioning, but through him there goes an influence of protection. An influence which, without compelling the other, helps him to direct his steps in the right way. The other won't know it usually, but that's how it will happen. This extraordinary influence, silent influence, of the one who has realized. Now all of us, in a lovely and simple way, sometime or other experience that in our lives. Say at school, for instance, or in the university. In the presence of a really good teacher with whom one is in rapport, one's own understanding just opens out quite easily. And you can do things, whatever the subject may be, which normally you couldn't do. Solve differential equations. Goodness knows what. You see? It happens like that, doesn't it? In art, in the presence of the great master, the really devoted, ardent pupil, granted that he is in rapport with the master as a living person, will also do wonders. But it is that kind of thing which happens. But don't get carried away. If you ever experience any such contact, because it is so easy to make mistake after mistake. I had such and such an experience, and you treasure the shape of that experience. And just how real was that experience? Or was it a figment of imagination? Born, therefore, of self-esteem, of outright egoism and vanity. Because after all, if one lays claim to such things in that rather silly manner in which people do lay claim that way, if one lays claim to such things, why does he do so? Because there has been frustration in actual fact, in this, that, or the other direction. And he does this as a compensation for his own egoism, for his own vanity. So one must beware of such things. He knows, usually he knows, such a man knows, that the person to whom he is talking has no means of challenging or seeing whether his claim is true or not. Does an ordinary person know what is going on in the mind of another person? He doesn't. He sometimes can judge from the tone of the voice, the particular expressions he uses, the gestures he may make, and if he's a very sensible, perceptive person, he knows this fellow's a bit of a humbug, bogus. See? But we can be humbugs with ourselves far more subtly and dangerously to ourselves than be humbugs in relationship to other people. So beware of these things, because they do have a considerable influence for deterioration of the character. That is why one must never meddle with things of the spirit. You know how often I have said in these groups these 18 years nearly, why do you turn to religion? And I have tried hard to keep people away from religion. Because quite seriously, it is dynamite. And if you don't know how to use it properly, you may not feel very comfortable with the after effects of the use of that dynamite. See? Now, you find in all the religions these these references to archangels, angels, devas, as they say in India, and so forth. They are not one of them is rejected. But do not think, therefore, that the ordinary picture presented of them as beings or with golden wings or platinum harps or whatever it is, you see, that all that has any meaning at all. It simply means that there are these energies, and if one lives the religious life, one becomes more and more sensitive. When I say religious life, also the practice of yoga and such things, you see, one becomes more and more sensitive, and those forces naturally affect the sensitized apparatus, one's own psychophysical organism. So be always mindful, always alert to these things. Now, I have said all this because all these things are possibilities of human consciousness. And you will appreciate that there are two contexts involved here. First, let me make it clear, I say two contexts, not meaning that they are different or separate contexts. But in order to speak at all, I have to say two contexts. There is the context of the finite, the temporal, the mortal, in which all of us human beings live and function as we are. There is the context of the infinite, the eternal, not temporal, and the immortal. At the same time, I would say quite unequivocally that in actual fact there is only one reality, one total reality. It is convenient to talk in terms of the two contexts. The immortal is not the opposite of the mortal. It is life, eternal life, which brings to birth any particular thing or creature or person or whatever it is. It is that same eternal life which brings about the dissolution, the death, as we call it, of that person or thing or whatever it is. And that is the meaning of the immortal. It is life which does it. Life is not the opposite of death. Death in its reality is inseparable from life in manifestation. Because life in concrete manifestation, that means in terms of manifestation of variety and therefore of separate finites, involves the changing of any finite in the course of its manifestation. Any finite has a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending, which means that there is continuous change. let us assume that that change is what we may truly call growth, development, and coming to fruition. Well, the change, that kind of change, involves the complete leaving behind the previous state. The previous state grows into the next state. And once it has grown, you can't go back. Can any of us go back to the state we were in 10 years ago or even 10 hours ago? We can't. There is this perpetual change, which means that what we commonly describe by the word death has taken place with respect to the original state. Our life, the continuity of our life is a continuity through the instrumentality of death. If constant death didn't take place, our life wouldn't continue as a living, growing organism, obviously. Now it's unpicturable for us, isn't it? Our imaginative faculties haven't got the capacity to respond in complete harmony with the extraordinary pulse of creation. Now, if one really is able to see that as a simple fact, really to see it, to be at home with it, then unconsciously we are conscious in the truest and completest sense of eternal life, here and now, of immortality. Then we function as an immortal functions. As the immortal functions. You see, the difficulty which arises with all attempts to express these things, with all theologies, with all philosophies which touch ontological problems, problems of ultimate being and ultimate reality and so forth. The two contexts, now here it is convenient to say two contexts, are continuously mixed up. There is not a system of philosophy in existence where you don't find errors in verbal form and therefore in terms of concepts because of the muddling up of the two contexts. The transcendent subsumes the finite, the temporal, the mortal. But our capacity here, because it is limited by the concreteness of our brain, the brain is the most concrete expression of mind. The brain is particular to that body, to that living body, but mind is not particular, it's universal, it's total. You see? So now, when this particular and finite tries to present the total, of course it makes mistakes. It cannot do it. It hasn't got the means to do it. As and when it itself becomes completely at one with that totality, and this is one of the marvels and of the great mystery of the finite expressing by being the infinite, When that happens, there is silence. This is one of the profoundest meanings of the word silence. It's not silence in that sense, is not the opposite of noise. Not at all. It includes all sound. We use the word noise to represent disagreeable sound. We say music to represent agreeable sound. Now you see, the silence, that which belongs to transcendence itself, characterizes transcendence. It's not very wise of me to say characterizes in that context, but perhaps you will understand. You see? That silence subsumes all sound. That eternity subsumes both time and the timeless. You'll find it, at least I have never come across any philosopher, and I think you'll find it difficult to come across any philosopher and his philosophy in which he didn't fall into the trap of identifying timelessness with eternity. Timelessness can be, and often is, a real experience with us human beings. But we enter into that timeless state, and then it comes to an end. Its boundaries are time. But eternity is something quite different. There is no boundary to it. There is no acceptance or rejection in it. If you like to think of eternity as the absolute container, it is also the contained then. And the contained is known and experienced by us as time and the timeless. I'm saying these things because it's so easy for us to have an experience of something like that and think, ah, I was one with the divine, and so forth. And I was one with the divine. I never was. The divine, the totality, the timeless, the eternal, takes this up into itself, because this has completely ceased to resist. Which doesn't mean that it has become non-existent, that it has become annihilated. See, this is the sort of thing which philosophers try to put into words and always fail. I'm not suggesting for a moment that what I have said is a proper expression, not at all. I only talk in this manner in order to perhaps help the listener to realize that we can only be less and less misleading where expressing transcendence is concerned. Transcendence will express itself quite easily through us. But its expressing is something utterly different from our concept or experience of expression. Now you see, one may say, but oh, this is such airy-fairy philosophy, all up in the clouds. Well, you know, clouds are not useless. Without clouds, we'd never have another drink. Do Don't forget that. It is not all up in the clouds in that sense, that it is airy-fairy nonsense. If we do begin to thrill in response to such things, at the real ontological level, the profoundest level that we can touch, then so many mistakes we make in our lives would not occur at all. We wouldn't have to fight against them. We wouldn't have to exercise self-control or be on our guard against them. Whenever we are on our guard, we are on our guard against the rest of the universe. Is that the case? We are not on our guard against any one particular person or thing, because that one particular person or thing is interrelated with the totality, just as each of us is interrelated with the totality. So you see, the unnecessary conflict is out of the picture. And then you naturally just do the right thing. It happens through you. You don't do it. There is no separate you involved in it. That is to say, a consciously separate you. How often in our life we have said, I wouldn't dream of doing such a thing. And we say it with such snobbish superiority and contempt of the other person who is thereby subtly castigated by us. I wouldn't dream of doing such a thing. Maybe I can't do such a thing, that is why. And so forth. Understanding the nature of our consciousness lies at the very root of humanity coming to fulfillment through our own psychophysical being. That is why these things are important. They are not meant to be intellectual pleasures, gratification. They are quite serious. At the same time, don't struggle to understand. Just let it be. As we might say in India, use your subtle senses. You know, the Sankhya philosophy, one of the six great systems of philosophy in India, presented this idea right from the beginning, that behind, they said, of course they had to use such language, behind and underlying our obvious physical senses are the subtle senses. But no explanation is ever given what you mean by these subtle senses. But as we sort of begin to be aware of this, these subtle senses operate. And these subtler functionings of our own psyche are in line, in tune with the great life trend working through mankind. And that brings the individual to a state of inner poise and peace quite naturally. And he doesn't have to struggle to maintain that in the midst of difficulty and trouble. He is just naturally like that. You know how often, well, perhaps not so often, but it occurs at times, if there is a room full of people who are very disturbed and so on, and somebody gets up quietly and says something, or happens to walk in and look round and everything suddenly becomes calm. What's happened to all the hubbub? It's vanished. So too with our inner life. The trouble, the hubbub disappears. And then there is true peace, there is true happiness, which is essential for coming to fruition.